Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from The Voice of America. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear stories from Anna Mateo, Brian Lynn, Ashley Thompson, and Katie Weaver. But first, the Higher Education Report. A college or university campus is more than just an area for classes, research, and studying. Many aim to be communities. That is why so many schools want students to feel like the campus is their home. One way colleges and universities in the United States build community is to require students to live on campus for at least some amount of time. The buildings where students live are called dormitories or dorms. They include shared living spaces, usually designed to fit two or more people. They also often have bathrooms and eating areas that all residents share. Nick Lander gives several reasons so many schools require new students to live in the dorms. Lander is the Associate Director of Residence Life at Kansas State University in Manhattan, Kansas. Research shows that students who live on campus do better in terms of academic success and in learning where everything is on campus, he told VOA. Research also shows that campus residents do better at making connections with their professors and other students. Connections with other students are important, says Lander. Many new students are between 18 and 23 years old, an age when some might benefit from having others around to help them grow as independent adults. So even at schools like his, which do not require students to live on campus, dorm life is a choice the students might want to consider. They may be doing their own laundry for the first time, Lander said. They may be sharing spaces with another person for the first time. They may be, in some cases, responsible for making their own meals. So those things kind of happening in a collaborative environment where there's support and people they can share those experiences with, I think makes a very positive impact for students. However, he admits that living with strangers is not always easy. First-year students are not often able to choose exactly who their roommates will be. Also, some people really value their privacy. Colleges and universities in the U.S. try to admit as many different kinds of people as they can. This might cause difficulties for people who grew up in places where the majority of people were just like them, Lander says. That is why schools with on-campus housing try to offer strong residence life programs and services. One thing almost all college dormitories have are resident assistants, or RAs. These are students who have already been studying at the school for some time. In exchange for pay or free housing, they act as representatives of the school, ensuring students are safe and follow the rules. They also connect students with whatever campus resources they may need and plan fun or informational events. There are usually also several full-time employees on campuses acting as resident directors. They are trained to solve disputes between residents and give them the skills to create an enjoyable, healthy community. Lander suggests that making use of these services and programs while in college can help prepare students for situations in the real world. When you have a job and you're sharing an office space, for example, with another person, or you're in a relationship, or you have a family, you have to learn how to deal with conflict. You have to learn how to communicate, he said. After their first year, more housing choices open up for college students. Schools often offer their larger living spaces only to students in their second year or above. These students are also usually able to choose their roommates. But for complete freedom, students can always choose to live off campus, Lander notes. Many of the cities and towns surrounding college and university campuses have plenty of private property owners that are willing to rent to students. And the schools sometimes offer online or in-person services to help students find a place to live off campus. Landers says that students may not enjoy all the same services living off campus and may face difficulties if they end up living with non-students. But they do often experience a deeper connection to the local community outside the school. I'm Pete Musto.
Now the VOA Learning English Program, Words and Their Stories. Today, we are down on the farm. Since the 16th century, the word farm has meant land used for agricultural purposes. But a much older meaning is related to economics. The English word farm comes from the Latin word firma, which means an unchanging payment. Experts say the earliest meaning of farm was a yearly payment made on a loan or as a tax. Centuries ago, English farmers did not own their land. They made payments to the owner for the right to grow crops. Okay, so the word farm has roots in economics. Therefore, it's no surprise to hear about someone buying a farm. A farm. That is very different from someone who has bought the farm. When someone tells you that someone bought the farm, do not offer your congratulations. Bought the farm is a lighthearted way to say that a person has died. Now, buying the farm is very different from betting the farm. When you bet the farm, you are willing to risk everything because you are confident in something. Used in conversation, it may sound like this. Jack was out really late last night. I'm willing to bet the farm that today he will be late for work. So you can buy, own, or bet a farm. You can also just farm, as in the verb. But today, the verb farm has come to mean something more than raising crops. To farm something out means to give work or duties to someone else to finish. This farming action is quite different from planting and raising crops. To do that, farmers plant seeds. You could say that seeds start the growth process. In business, seed money is the financing you need to launch a project or company. Now, sometimes we call the act of raising crops sowing crops. To sow means to plant seeds in the ground. The verb sow also means to set in motion or to cause something to exist, especially things such as fear, doubt, or suspicion. We use the word sow in two common idioms. Let's say you have a friend who shows a lack of common sense, and does stupid, crazy things. You might defend their behavior by saying, "Oh, he doesn't mean any harm. He's just sowing his wild oats." When someone sows their wild oats, they act foolishly and make bad decisions when they are young. Many people learn from their wild mistakes of youth, some the hard way. They might have to reap what they sow. This expression means that we all must deal with the results of our actions. Young and old alike might one day have to reap what they sow. However, if your friend continues to act foolishly, you could plant a seed of caution in him. To plant a seed in someone is to influence another person's thinking or behavior. And as we just heard, you can plant a seed of something. Americans often use the expression to plant a seed of doubt. If that seed, whether of doubt, caution, or some other idea, takes root, it begins to develop into something bigger. If it dies on the vine, it doesn't grow into anything worth keeping, just something else to clean up. We can also say that a plant, person, or idea has gone to seed. To go to seed is to worsen in condition because of lack of care. This expression is based on the actual meaning of plants that go to seed. They stop producing flowers and start producing seeds. Now, let's hear these common farming expressions used in a casual conversation about work. Two friends, on their way to work, stop for coffee and to talk shop. They talk about work.
I want to stop for coffee before heading into work. Do you have time?
Sure. Actually, I want to hear about your new startup. So how is your new product launch going?
It's going better now, but I ran into a rough patch a few weeks ago.
What happened?
Well, a man who worked for me was trying to steal my customers. After every meeting with a customer, he would pull them aside and try to plant seeds of doubt about whether my business was the right fit for them.
Wow, that's awful. What did you do?
I fired him.
It's a good thing his attempts to hurt your business didn't take root.
Actually, in the end, it only hurt him. Word got around, and now people don't trust him. So he hasn't been able to find another job. I saw him the other day, and he looks awful. He has really gone to seed.
You know what they say, you reap what you sow. If you do bad things, you will sooner or later have to deal with the results.
That is so true. But now I have another problem, money. I used up all the seed money I had saved for the project.
I know you pretty well. I'll bet the farm that you will not let your business die on the vine.
No way. I have already found another investor. And I started farming out the artwork to some university students. That will save me a lot of money.
Well, it sounds like you're really busy, but happy.
I love my work. You know, I was talking to an old college friend last night. We both sowed our wild oats when we were younger. Now that we're older and hopefully wiser, we are perfectly happy spending much of our time on work.
You know, I never did anything too crazy when I was younger. Maybe these restless feelings I have are my wild oats that I didn't sow. Maybe I'll quit my job and travel around Europe for a month.
That sounds fun. But let me plant a seed of caution. Before you quit your job, save up a lot of money and have another job waiting for when you get back.
Well, that doesn't sound like a crazy wild time.
Exactly. You're not in your 20s anymore.
Good point. Well, here's our coffee order.
This one's on me. If you're going to be traveling around Europe, you better start saving your money now.
Cheers.
Cheers.
And that brings us to the end of Words and Their Stories. Hopefully, some of these farm expressions will take root in your everyday English. I'm Ana Mateo.
There are fears that much-needed foreign aid to Afghanistan will decrease once international military forces withdraw from the country. Aid experts say a drop in assistance would worsen Afghanistan's humanitarian crisis. United States and Taliban representatives are attempting to negotiate an agreement to end nearly 18 years of fighting. Such a deal could raise questions about the future of aid from other countries. The biggest victims in Afghanistan are children. The United Nations Children's Agency, UNICEF, estimates that about 2 million Afghan boys and girls face severe malnutrition. Of those, about 600,000 could die without urgent treatment, UNICEF said. One example of this urgency can be seen in Jabul Siraj, a mountainside community north of the capital, Kabul. On a visit to Jabul Siraj, a reporter from the Associated Press saw a woman holding a 7-month-old boy. Days before, the boy was receiving emergency medical care. Now he was drinking a special food mixture supplied by a UNICEF-supported nutrition program. Nearby, other mothers lined up with their children for food. Fariba Hashimi is a healthcare worker at a hospital in a nearby city. The hospital treats more than 1,000 children a month for malnutrition. She says the problem is getting worse. It's mostly an economic issue, for mothers as well, Hashimi told the AP. They can't breastfeed because they don't have enough income to feed themselves. Healthcare and other basic services, such as power supplies, are unpredictable across the country. The World Bank has estimated that outside assistance pays for about 75% of total public spending. The bank has warned of the dangers of a quick reduction in international aid flows. Afghanistan has received more American aid than any other country since the U.S.-led invasion to oust the Taliban in 2001. Even after billions of dollars in assistance, more than half of its people still live in poverty. Much of the aid has gone to security efforts. Many Afghans say a lot of the money has also been wasted through government corruption and bad management. U.S. government aid to Afghanistan was cut in half in 2014, the year that U.S. and NATO forces officially ended military operations there. About 20,000 forces remain, largely to train and support Afghan forces. Alex Thier once directed assistance for the country with the U.S. Agency for International Development. He told the AP that if a U.S.-Taliban agreement brings badly needed peace, Afghanistan could actually see an increase in aid. But if the peace process lasts a long time or fails, it could reduce the enthusiasm for giving, he said. Political observers say some groups would be slow to donate to a Taliban-influenced government that does not respect the rights of women and others. The Taliban has suggested it wants international aid to continue after an agreement. Alex Thier says it is his understanding that the U.S. Taliban talks have included discussions on ways to keep foreign aid flowing. He said that information on the negotiations came from diplomats and people tied to the Taliban. The local UN humanitarian representative, Toby Lanzer, says he does not believe foreign aid will decrease. Lanzer told the AP he believes the humanitarian situation is so serious that many donors will agree that aid efforts must continue. I'm Brian Lynn.
Our national parks journey takes us to New Orleans, Louisiana, the city many consider to be the birthplace of jazz. New Orleans is a port city at the mouth of the Mississippi River. It holds one of the most famous cultural celebrations in America, the New Orleans Jazz and Heritage Festival, called Jazz Fest for short. The first New Orleans Jazz and Heritage Festival took place in 1970. That year, about 350 people attended the five-day celebration. 5 years later, about 80,000 people attended the festival. Today, attendance is measured in hundreds of thousands. The festival's original organizers said the event could only be held in New Orleans, because here and here alone is the richest music tradition in America. And only in New Orleans could you find a whole national park honoring jazz. Today, we are exploring the New Orleans Jazz National Historical Park.
The park includes sites important to jazz history in New Orleans. Visitors can walk around the city to see these sites. They include places located in the oldest part of the city, the French Quarter, as well as in the Louis Armstrong Park.
Now, ladies and gentlemen, here's one you all can sing with us when the Saints go marching in.
Louis Armstrong is one of the greatest American jazz musicians. His voice, trumpet playing skill, and creativity continue to influence jazz artists today. Armstrong was born in New Orleans in 1901. Jazz was just beginning to develop when Louis was a boy. It grew out of the blues songs and ragtime music that had been popular at the turn of the century. Louis Armstrong discovered music early in life. He was surrounded by it. By the time he was 18, he joined the Kid Ory Band, one of the finest bands in New Orleans. In the 1920s, Armstrong moved on to Chicago, and then New York, which had become major centers of jazz music. The trumpeter soon became one of the most famous musicians of his time. In the 1930s, he had his own big band, called Louis Armstrong and His Orchestra. But his biggest hits came later in his life. In 1964, his version of the song Hello Dolly was the top hit around the world. And the song What a Wonderful World recorded in 1968, was his final big hit.
Red roses too, I see them blue for me and you.
Armstrong died in 1971. In 1980, the city of New Orleans opened the Louis Armstrong Park to honor one of the city's most famous sons. Among other sites, the park includes a statue of Armstrong himself and a place called Congo Square. Throughout history, the square has had many names. Congo Square was once used as an area where slaves were permitted to perform African and Caribbean dances and drumming. The sounds played a role in the development of jazz. Today, the city holds the annual Congo Square Rhythms Festival there.
Another stop within the New Orleans Jazz National Historical Park is the J&M Recording Studio. It lies just south of the Louis Armstrong Park on Rampart Street. The studio operated from 1945 to 1955. Cosimo Matassa, a recording engineer, was the owner of the studio. He recorded some of the greatest jazz and rhythm and blues artists of the time. Today, the spot is a laundromat. But a small sign on the building points out its important place in music history.
Next, we visit the Mint. A mint is a place that produces coins. The Mint started out as a place where U.S. and Confederate currency was made. But today, the Mint has a famous performing arts center and a museum full of jazz history. That museum is the Louisiana State Museum. Here, visitors can see Louis Armstrong's first cornet, a brass instrument similar to a trumpet. He bought it in New Orleans when he was 15 years old. The National Park Service holds live educational performances at the Mint most days of the week. Many of those performances are streamed live online for viewers around the world to enjoy.
Another park site is Preservation Hall in the French Quarter. The word preservation means keeping or protecting for the future. By the early 1960s, traditional New Orleans jazz music was in danger of disappearing. Young people wanted to hear the music of Elvis Presley and other rock and roll stars. Not many young people were interested in listening to jazz. In 1961, Alan and Sandra Jaffe began using a small old building on St. Peter's Street as a music hall. Musicians there played traditional New Orleans jazz, sometimes just for their own enjoyment. Alan Jaffe was a tuba player. He played with what became known as the Preservation Hall Jazz Band. The Jaffes created Preservation Hall to protect and preserve the city's traditional jazz sounds. Today, different bands play at the hall each night. Musicians also still play in the Preservation Hall Jazz Band. They play in concert halls around the United States. I'm Ashley Thompson.
And I'm Katie Weaver.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy.